The Seder that we are reading now gives us a special opportunity to try and understand the nature and the relationship between Jew and non-Jew. What actually is the difference between Jew and non-Jew? It's got many practical applications here. We're talking about intermarriage, many other practical applications. A very fundamental issue. Hard to imagine that there's a subject that's more fundamental than this. And the unique thing about this subject, the unique thing about this subject is that we understand it very poorly. In fact, it's probably safe to say that this is a subject that the non-Jew understands better than we do. The natural distinction between Jew and non-Jew, the Torah attitude to what is the distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew, that's something that the non-Jewish world understands probably a lot better than we do. Let's see if we can understand why that strange fact is true. And let's see if we can understand something about what we are supposed to understand about this. Let's just make it clear right now. We're not here to talk about better or worse, right? That's just not the object of this discussion. It's like we wouldn't begin to discuss whether man or woman, one is better than the other. Right? We would discuss within the Torah framework massive differences that exist between a man and a woman without having any concept of one being better than the other. Two completely different identities, two spiritual and mystical sources, two different roles to fulfill in the world. Well, we're not talking about better or worse. And I have to say that because this discussion usually comes out as sounding like, you know, that there's an element of bigotry here. And that's, of course, not what we are, not what we're saying. If there is an element of good and bad here, then the bad is one person doing what he's not supposed to be doing. If the non-Jews would live the way non-Jews are supposed to live, if they would live up to their obligations spiritually, we'll try and explain what they are, the world would be fine. Of course, on the other hand, we're not exactly living up to our Torah Jewish obligations either. Right? If we would do that, the world would certainly be fine. So the problem here is when one or other crosses the line and starts to behave like the other one. That's when you have a problem. But each one, each group, each individual doing what he's supposed to be doing is, of course, perfection. Nobody's going to be held, cannot be held against any individual that he happened to be born this or that. Just like if you're born a woman, then you'd be foolish to be resentful of the fact that there's certain mitzvahs that you don't do. If you're a man, you'd be foolish to resent the fact that if you're not a Kohen, you don't have certain obligations and privileges of a Kohen or a Levi, etc., etc. Okay? Nobody's equal at all, but everybody has to discover what it is that makes you unique and learn how to fulfill that perfectly. And that's basic and fundamental. Now, there's a fantastic insight, a fascinating insight into the problem of the distinction between Jew and non-Jew, which is worth knowing. And I'll tell it to you exactly the way I heard it. Do not expect an explanation here. This is just a way of defining what cannot be explained. But yet, in defining what cannot be explained, it still gives a lot of clarity. That was my experience when I heard it. Let's try and understand. Once I heard a very great man, one of the leaders of this, the leading rabbinic sages of this generation, say the following thing. This is what he said. In the course of discussion, he said the following thing. He said that some years ago, he was sitting and talking to a certain sage who was one of the leaders of this generation who's no longer alive. Very, very great rabbinic authority, a great man in the mystical world also. And this man was relating a certain incident. I heard it from somebody who heard it from him. And he said the following thing. He said, and the discussion begins in an unrelated way, but I'm going to tell it to you the way I heard it. It's some interesting to hear this. It's amazing to hear it. Fascinating for our generation. And you'll see the connection between the two issues. This is what happened. He said the following thing. He said that sometime before this, a young man had come to him. Now we're talking about, this man died in 1961, I think. So we're talking about sometime before that. He said that a young man had come to him and asked him the following question. He had asked him why it was that a false ideology had taken hold of this generation. Okay? I don't want to credit invalid and false systems even by mentioning their names. But I think you know what I'm talking about. This young man asked him why it was that Europe had been swept by a philosophy of social, let's call it social behavior, social existence, right, that had swept the intellectual world at the time, around the beginning of the 1900s, especially 1917, in Eastern Europe, there had been a philosophy of equality of man economically, and that people should not... You with me? We have to talk about Torah, not to give isms to... Not to give isms to things that are not valid. We're here to, let's say, commune with each other. In Torah. That's why this isn't a social get-together, either. Anyway, those two isms... those two isms were the basis of an ideology that swept the intellectual world, and unfortunately many Jews were caught up, as we all know, in this idea. Not only were Jews caught up in it, the Torah world, there were inroads made into the Torah world, there were inroads made into the yeshivas, there were people of Torah understanding, there were people with Torah backgrounds who were swept away from the yeshiva world. There were certainly people swept away from the world of Jewish identity, were swept up in an ideology that was completely false and had no basis at all. Not only does this ideology have today, you don't even have to explain it. When this man was asked this question, the thing was still going strong. It was still a major power. This ideology was the basis of one of the world's major powers. The power to destroy the world, literally, was still held then in the hands of people who subscribed to this ideology. Today it's a hollow shell. One doesn't even have to describe its futility and stupidity. But in those days it still looked strong. This young man of insight asked this great rabbi why it was that an ideology that went against the nature of man, you take away a man's motivation to work. You tell him that he must work in a communal sort of a way where he won't reap the benefits of his work. The mystics point out, even the mystics point out that it's translated into Musa terms, that the way the world works is a person sets out to make a pair of shoes. A man becomes a shoemaker, and he sets out to make shoes. He thinks he's earning a living, but actually he's making me a pair of shoes. That's what they say. He thinks he's doing this. Why has he become a shoemaker? Because he needs to earn a living. But actually he's making me shoes. And there's somebody else who's a tailor who's doing it because he needs to earn a living, but actually he's making me clothes. It's an incredible system. That means he has his own vested interest, his own motivation that keeps him going, and the job gets done in society. But if you take away a person's motivation, and you tell him he must do the job anyway, and you take his own identity out of it, the uniqueness of what it means to be a human being is your own individual identity. And you develop a system where you smash a person's identity, and you say that he's just part of a massive machine, and you expect him to function and achieve his potential. I mean, that's so silly. And we're not here to talk about this subject. It's another subject. But the point is that it has to be explored more fully. Nevertheless, there was this ideology that had the potential for tremendous evil. First of all, it didn't make sense. Socially, it didn't make sense. Economically, it certainly doesn't make any sense. Morally, it's a terrible, terrible thing. Morally, it led to a society which is a very, very evil and murderous society. Anybody with any sense in any generation has known that if you want a moral and just society, you must have a religious society, even if you're not religious. Even if you don't feel religious, even if you're no connection to the spiritual world. But if you have a society where people believe in it, I mean, this is the worst and coarsest and crudest way of using religion. But if you have a society where people believe in a higher value and they're prepared to give their lives for it, that'll be a moral and just society, quite disregarding the fact of its truth. You have a society where there is no higher value, where a man becomes a machine, a woman becomes a machine in the production line. It mustn't make any difference either here and now economically or in the grander scale of things, and you still expect people to be motivated. So that's a system that's given to tremendous evil and is bound to fail, even in its own terms, apart from its evil in spiritual terms. So this young man, are we all together? So this young man's question was to this great rabbi, how was it that a system that had so little going for it, that everything against it, swept the world? And how was it that it took away the minds of people who were able to think for themselves? That's what bothered him. That's what bothered him. There were young Jews of that generation, young intellectuals, who were able to think out things for themselves. There were people with training in Gemara. They could analyze an issue, and they could independently analyze an issue, and not be swayed by emotions. They could analyze something intellectually. They were trained that way, and they were swept away by nonsense. Quite an interesting question. Not a bad question. Important question. This was the answer this great man gave. Remarkable concept to understand. A remarkable and central, unexpected idea. He said that he had answered like this. He was relating the story, and he said that he had answered this young man in the following way. He quoted him a Gemara. There's a Gemara, a remarkable Gemara, that says like this. The Gemara says the following thing. Achas b'shivim shana, once in 70 years, Oile Keichav, a star rises, Shemate es Asapani. How you translate that is something like this. There's a star that rises that misleads the ship's captains, or the ship's navigators, let's say. They're the seamen, that's how you'd say it. Sfina is a ship in Hebrew. Sapani means the seafarers, the seamen. Which is like this. It means like this. Once every 70 years, let's try and analyze this Gemara. Incredible. That's all the Gemara says. So try and understand the little meaning in it. He said this. Once every 70 years, remarkable thing, we're talking from 1917 till when? Till 1987. It's remarkable. When did it collapse? Huh? Very close, no? Very close. Understand? Once every 70 years, there's a star that rises, and this star misleads the people who need to navigate. That's what the Gemara says. So explain like this. This is what it means. Of course, the Gemara is not interested in talking about the Gemara. He's not talking about astronomy or about navigation at sea. The Gemara is a spiritual document. It's using an analogy, a metaphor, to explain something spiritual. It means this. Once every 70 years, there's a star, but what the Gemara means literally is that a star rises out of place. It says it misleads the... It doesn't say that they make a mistake. It says the star misleads them. Understand this carefully. Every word here is critical. There's a star that makes its appearance in the astrological system, and this star is out of place. It shouldn't be there. It should be somewhere else. So what happens? The people who know about navigation, they read the stars, and they take the direction according to the combination, constellation of stars, and they get misled, and they sail wrong. But it's not their fault. It's not their fault. The star's out of place. Maybe they should know better than to trust one apparent reading, and they should look at the solid nature of the background. That you could discuss this question. But nevertheless, there is something in the firmament outside of them, that... So he said this. First of all, once in 70 years means this. The basic meaning of this Gemara is this. The Gemara is not talking about stars. The Gemara is talking about things that people steer by emotionally and spiritually and in terms of life decisions. That means, when a person chooses a pathway in life, it is with reference to an outside system. When a person wants to know what's right and wrong, he has an environment around him that charts his course. And it's against, or at least you chart your course by the given variables of your, and exigencies of your particular situation. And you read the signs, and you chart because of those things, sometimes against them, sometimes with them. But the conditions and variables that surround you, with your own inner ability to know what's right and wrong, and what yes a direction and what's not a direction, you put that against the environment, and that's how you steer your course in life. Now it seems that there is a system of stars. That means there's a, so again the star, why it was chosen, the stars here, the very deep thing, it's because the whole astrological world actually is the route, the deepest a person can go. When a person wants to chart his course, the Gemara is not choosing an analogy by accident. When a person wants to chart his course in life, he looks obviously at the deepest things that he can look at. A person is not going to chart his course by things that come and go, that are gone in a day. A person tries to chart what it is that he's supposed to be doing in life by looking at the deepest factors that work in his own personality and the personalities of the people around him and the forces that seem to have the deepest effect in life. Mystically, that's always called the stars. I'm not going to go into why that is now. Now, that's what happens. It means that there's a set of variables, and that is what a person considers to be reality. And a person steers his course in life according to reality that he perceives. Now, once every 70 years, whenever you see in Chazal, in the sages, whenever they talk about 70 years, there's a principle here, and it means once in a lifetime. 70 years, the Torah says, is a basic concept of a lifetime. And therefore, where it says 70 years, it means, oh, wait, why choose that figure? It means once in a complete life cycle. That means everybody in their own life cycle will come face to face with one particular star that's out of place. Remarkable thing to know. And you have to be on your guard for what that star is, because you dare not pay attention to that star. Once every 70 years also means an entire life cycle. It means an adult lifehood of one generation. That means that every generation that crosses the face of the earth has an identity and has a special nature and a special task. And each generation will be able to look at stars, and there'll be one out of place. Let's try and translate it, what it means in Tachlis. It means that everybody will be confronted, right? You have to understand this. Everybody will be confronted with a set of variables that you can trust. Because reality won't let you down, right? Reality is reality, not given there to fool you, beyond a certain point. But there's one element in your constellation of reality that's put there only to lead you astray. Not that you're misreading it. It is wrong. And there's no way you could tell. It's out of place in the sky. It's not that you're not looking straight. in the firmament of what is supposed to be all the variables, there's one that's put there only to mislead you. That's its function. Everybody has that, and every generation has that. Let's speak about generations. So he said like this, it means that for every 70 years, we'll have as its guiding star a very appealing bright star that 70 years later will crumble. It will collapse in front of... people will see, people who live to that stage will see that it was complete nonsense. They'll see that it didn't check out at all. It had no place at all, completely out of place compared to the rest of reality. But while it was there, it was so bright that you felt compelled to give your life for it. And he said that we are now living through a generation where this span of 70 years, right, is that particular ideology. That's what it is. It's that social whirlwind. Right, that concept of social, economic, political, social reform and reality which has swept the world, the intellectual world, the biggest intellectual centers of the world. And the Jewish nation is definitely led astray by that because they're at the forefront of ideology. They're the ones who are watching the stars. And they're at the forefront of it. And without any ability to control it, they'll be led astray by that thing. And that's what it is now. It's these isms that are completely foolish that even now, if you wish to, you can see right through them. That is what has led people astray. It's a fantastic thing. It means, of course, that you have to understand the blame. You have to understand the blame. You have to understand that it's people who could have done better, but there was a very powerful element that made it impossible for them to do better. They couldn't trust themselves in this area. You follow? Things that a person's conscience can tell him are right or wrong, so that you can trust. But it seems that there's certain areas where you can't trust. There's some areas you can't go by the natural system, because there's something put into that natural system that's designed to mislead you. Now the idea is clear. And of course we saw it. This was said 20 years ago. We've been fortunate to see the thing crumble entirely. It was gone in a day, virtually. And the thing crumbled in such an embarrassing way that even the people who were supposed to subscribe to the thing actually didn't even have any words. They didn't have no justifications even. Didn't even try and sort of backtrack and say, well, it was a problem. Did you hear anybody say that, yes, it was valid, just that right now we've moved into a phase where actually it's not necessary anymore. Did anyone say that? Did you see that in your intellectual writings? Did you see anybody actually say, well, it is still valid, but, you know, it's not its time. It was a messianic vision that we'll get. They don't even attempt to justify. Even the people, the big experts, the people who gave their lives to it, the people who built the whole, even they have just completely dropped it in ruins, in fragments, looking elsewhere. I mean, there's no question about this. Now, that's all very interesting, but it's not tonight's subject, although it relates. Now, the next thing that happened in the conversation was this. He said that when he explained this to the young man, and that was it. Then the person who told me this great sage, my Rebbe, as it happens, he said that at that point of the conversation, he turned to this great man and he said to him, what's the star that's misleading our generation? That's what he asked him. What is it? If this is a star that's had its run, and this is an ideology and a set of isms, that have led this generation astray to the point where Jewish blood was spilled. I mean, the Jews gave their lives for that ideology. They put themselves into the forefront of it. And of course, they were killed by both sides. They were killed, they were butchered, right, by the ideology itself, by both parties, by the ones they tried to support. It was held against them by all parties, as is always the case. And that's now waning. Even then, they could see they didn't have much future. It's now waning. What's the star? What's the ism? What's the ideology? What's the spiritual, social, emotional thing that's put into this generation that misguides this generation of Jews, of the world? And he answered the following thing. He said, I think, what he thinks you should know for us is true. Okay? I'm talking about somebody on the level where what he says he thought can take as truth. He said, I think it is the blurring of the distinction between Jew and non-Jew. Hear that? That means, as a leading sage, who is an almost unquestioned leader of the certain part of this century, his opinion is that what's misleading us in an almost uncontrollable way is the blurring of the natural distinction between what is a Jew and what is a non-Jew. I'm trying to understand this. I told you that this wouldn't explain anything. Right? Just identify something which cannot be understood. But that helps a lot. That means that people of this generation cannot understand the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. Let's just first of all examine its truth before we try and understand it, if we can. I'll give you one or two examples just to feel it out in tangible terms. You know, you have a unique phenomenon in this generation. Unique phenomenon that you see over and over. People who work in the Tshuva movement, who work with youth, who are becoming more interested in Judaism. We see this all the time. And that is a very strange fracture between people of the previous generation and people of this generation. And that is usually like this. We're talking now, if you want to generalize it, when I say this generation, I mean the youth of this generation. And in many cases, you can trace it back already to people who are already the parents of this generation. People who today are in their 40s and maybe even 50s. In many instances not, but in many cases, yes, do fall into this category. People who today are in their 60s and 70s, approximately, roughly, let's say, and beyond, fit into what I call the previous generation. I might be wrong with the figures, but that's roughly the picture, roughly the scene. What is it? What is it? What is it? It's like this. Typical scene is this. You have here a family that is very minimally Jewish. They eat unkosher food. They maybe keep a kosher, maybe they don't. They have a Friday night meal, maybe, when it suits them, right? Or when they can, when nothing else big happening. Send the kids maybe to a Jewish school, maybe, maybe not. But they've certainly got a Jewish consciousness. The parents are both Jewish. Parents are both Jewish. Right? And it's a Jewish home, to greater or lesser extent. One day the child comes home with a girlfriend, a boyfriend who's not Jewish. And the home is smashed. Shattered. Shattered with an emotion that the parents, the worst part of it for the parents, you speak to parents who have this emotion, you'll see that what happens is they can't even explain to you why they feel this way about it. They suddenly try and put across to the child what's going on. They never thought they had to explain this to the child. You see, what happens is the child comes home with it. The first thing is shock. Shock sets in. The parents realize that here's a boy or a girl, they're very intimately serious about this other boy or girl, very nice person, but not Jewish. The first thing is the shock of how you could do such a thing. Then the child turns around in innocence to the parents and says, but what's actually wrong here? About human beings? Isn't he a nice person? Isn't she a nice person? What's the problem? So the parent can't find the words. That's the norm. The parent cannot find the words to explain to the child what's wrong, because on a logical basis, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. When the child starts telling the parent, but what's in it? One minute. We live in a world of equality, right? Rights for all, equality of rights, and so forth and so on. I mean, you know, what's actually the problem? So the parent starts to explain to the child, but one second, you're Jewish. And the child says, that's very nice, and this person's Italian, so what's the problem? So I'm Jewish, and he's Italian, what's the problem? So the parent tries to explain the enormous difference that he can't find the words for it. And the truth is that that's even if you're very articulate and you know a lot about Judaism, you can't find the words. Huh? Because it doesn't lie in the words. It lies in an area that is a natural, yep, you either have it or you don't have it. The parents have this feeling that there's a deadness knowledge, that there's a difference between Jew and non-Jew. And of course they can't put it into words. There are no words for it, but they know it as surely as they know they're alive. And the child doesn't know it as surely as they're alive. And it's not possible to explain by communication. So the parents launch into lectures of Jewish history. Doesn't make much impression. They slip the child to see Rabbi this and Rabbi that. Doesn't make an impression at all. You find there's nothing you can say that makes a difference because it doesn't rely on resting. I was once connected, it once struck me most sharply in a case that I was connected with a certain young lady. I happened to study together with this, did a certain course with this young lady. And I found out when I got to know her better, the following was the circumstances of her life. She had come from, I'm not going to tell you too many details. This girl came from a Jewish home in a certain part of Johannesburg where there was a sister, she had a sister. The two of them had been brought up with nothing Jewish at all. Okay? They never Friday night. There wasn't a siddur in the house. I never saw candlesticks. I never saw even heirlooms from a previous generation. They were sent to the local government school, not Jewish at all. So the best of my knowledge, there was nothing Jewish in the home at all. It was never discussed. There was no... They didn't have a bar mitzvah, they were girls. There was nothing that they studied. Didn't go to cheder. They weren't given any Jewish education at all. It was never an issue at all. It was never mentioned. The older sister married a non-Jew, and the parents disowned her. The girl married a non-Jew, and the parents refused to speak to her. They threw her out of the house and disowned her completely. And when I discussed this with this girl, who was a friend of mine, a co-student of mine, the father hadn't spoken to this other girl for 2 years that had never seen his grandson. The mother, the sister had been meeting secretly with her sister, and the mother lately had broken down and was meeting secretly, unbeknownst to the father, with the oldest daughter in order to be able to see her grandchild. Now, so I said to myself, one second, what's going on here? And I said to this girl, what's going on? They gave note, that's a remarkable thing. And by the way, it's not so atypical, the story. Not so atypical. The fracture may be a little bit more overt or a little less overt, but you'll see the story repeated, unfortunately, hundreds of times. On a global scale, maybe thousands. Just let's analyze for a second. What actually happened there? These parents, by the way, were professionals. They were professional, level-headed, very intelligent people whom I respected. When I knew these parents, They were level-headed. They were modest people. They were... I couldn't find any fault with them. They were certainly balanced individuals, given their children moral teachings and a structure and a discipline. Definitely. As good as the next, at least. What had happened? They gave their children no Jewish education at all. Nothing at all. And then when the children did the obvious thing, I mean, they were thrown into intimate contact with non-Jews, exactly the same as with Jews, and the distinction was never made. When the child did the natural thing, the reaction was, I mean, that's unreasonable, isn't it? If you teach your children from the time they're small that they must marry a Jew, and then they don't, they get upset. But you never mention it, and here a child does this, and what is going on? The obvious thing, it's obvious. Obviously what happened was the parents from a generation where the difference between non-Jew and Jew was absolutely obvious, nothing to talk about. Didn't have to, no one ever explained it to them. Do you think their grandparents, do you think in Lithuania the grandparents sat down and said, I want you to know that there's a difference between a Jew and a non-Jew? Do you think they sat down and explained it to them? It was painfully obvious usually, painfully obvious. And even in the next generation, it wasn't so painfully obvious when they reached societies where it wasn't an out-and-out war of persecution and belittlement from the non-Jewish oppressors. But it's not painfully obvious. The biggest insult you could ever insult a Jew was to say that he spoke like a goy. Let's be a goy. To say to a Jew that he spoke like a non-Jew. Not insulting the non-Jew necessarily, but that you should look like that. But this generation's very painfully embarrassed if you talk that way. So the parents, it was beyond their comprehension that a daughter of theirs could marry a non-Jew. And the truth is, it was beyond her comprehension how they could think that way. They were both completely right. Both completely right. There was no way in the world that that girl could ever begin to understand her parents' attitude. Why? Because the reality that's put into this generation is the inability to see it. It's not the girl's fault. It's not that she willfully turned her back on Jewish history and Judaism. She never had any to turn her back on. But that inbred blood, that aspect, that fire in the blood of a Jew that knows I'm Jewish, and it couldn't be a bigger difference between me, between two things in the world than between me and a non-Jew, that does not exist in this generation. It's a frightening message, this. It's a frightening message. One of the things it means is, do not think you can run a Jewish home and your children will get the message. That's not good enough. Don't think you can run a Jewish home and give them plenty of Jews. Do you think Jewish day schools make any difference at all to this? Do you think they make any difference? Go and examine the figures, right, of what the Jewish day schools, I'm not speaking, I don't mean to speak negatively, I went to a Jewish day school, and I turned out halfway normal. I went to a Jewish day school, and I'm proud of what I was taught, and I used it to very good advantage. But the rate of intermarriage and of consciousness of the difference between Jew and non-Jew, it's no more effective than a good Jewish home. Plenty of very, very Jewish conscious homes where the children don't have the consciousness at all. There's a remarkable clarity, this thing, because it explains to you, it doesn't explain anything, it shows you that you can't understand it, but it explains that there's a root that's taken outside. The non-Jews don't have this problem. Non-Jews don't have this problem. By and large, the vast majority of non-Jews who know what Jews are, don't have any problem about the distinction between Jew and non-Jew. There couldn't be anything more natural to them. I'm not saying that they're negative about it. They might not be negative. They might, yes, be, they might not be. But they have a very rich awareness of the difference between Jew and non-Jew. It's only too obvious when you relate to them deeply and you understand this issue, generally speaking. But Jews of this generation don't have that. Now, that's a remarkable thing, and that's the problem. And of course, that's the pre-messianic problem. The pre-messianic problem is going to be the one that's exactly counterpoised to our Jewish consciousness. Obviously, it's not an accident that this is the last ordeal. The last ordeal will be that when the Mashiach comes, he won't be able to find us. That's the last ordeal. When the redemption comes, it's not that we won't recognize him, he won't recognize us. It says that that's the threat. That's the threat. It says clearly that when Abraham, a remarkable thing, it says in the Midrashic writings that when Avram Avinu, when a Jew, in the next world it says that there's an entrance to Gehenna. Yes, there's an entrance to the dimension of painful, agonizing retribution in the world after this. Uncredited with its English name, which has graphic pictures that are not Jewish at all. There's a dimension of suffering, spiritual agony in the next world. At the entrance to that dimension sits a man. Just like it says, some of the mystics say that, just like it says in a Farsha a week ago, it says that he sits at the entrance to his tent waiting for visitors. It says he sits at the entrance to Gehenna, to this dimension of terrible non-existence and pain, to, yes, wait for visitors. Who? Jews who are about to enter, and he pulls them out. That's his function. He sits there and he waits and he pulls Jews. A Jew's about to enter. As he's about to enter that tremendous torture, Avraham Avinu pulls him out. How does he have such a merit? How can he do such a thing? How can he go against the judgment that you have against you? That, because the merit of his merit is so, what's called bris avos, the covenant, the bris, the covenant that the connection, covenant is always the bris mila, is a connection. It's always that area of making a covenant means bonding myself, bonding one person to another. With fruit, fruit is born from that. Obviously, that's what covenant means. Two halves making a whole that manifests as fruit in the world. He is the man who brings that covenant into the world between Hashem and us. The covenant between him and Hashem is so intense that Hashem would never let the Jew go into that dimension of punishment, even if the Jew deserves it, because he couldn't do it to Avraham Avinu. Understand this. You follow? What merit is it that he has to save somebody else who deserves to be put in there? The merit is because he doesn't deserve it. It's his child. How would a parent feel? How does a parent feel when their child is undeserving and the child gets punished? Yes, how is a person, when a person has a covenant with a friend, if a person has a beloved friend, and he looks after that friend, he gives his life for his friend, he do anything for his friend. What happens after the friend is no longer alive? He looks after the friend's children. Doesn't he do anything he could for his friend's child? Even if the child is undeserving, even if the child does not carry on the closeness and the relationship and everything he should have, but he feels obliged as a child and grandchild, even a grandchild. Wouldn't he continue, wouldn't he look after with loyalty a hapless grandchild of a person who had been the closest person to him in his life? Why? Not because the grandchild deserves it, he may not deserve it, but because the grandfather deserves it. So that's what Hashem does. Because he owes Avraham Avinu a debt, because he connects himself, he bonds himself to the debt, to the promise, to the covenant that he made with Abraham, with Avraham Avinu, he wouldn't let a great-grandchild of his suffer, not because the great-grandchild doesn't deserve to suffer, but because it would be a suffering for the great Zayder. And he doesn't deserve it. So out of risk, you follow what happens. It doesn't mean Avraham Avinu sits and pulls out. You're not talking childish words. We mean that his merit is so great that someone who may need to be punished, but his merit is so great that he deserves that his grandchild shouldn't have to go through that. That's what it says. But it says, except for two people. He's able to pull a Jew out of Gehenna, except for two people. A man who had an intimate physical relationship with a non-Jewish woman, and a man who tried to undo his circumcision. Those two. You hear that? A man who tries to undo his circumcision, that he shouldn't look Jewish, surgically tries to undo it, so there he can't be pulled out. And a man who had an intimate relationship with a non-Jewish woman, a Jewish man with a non-Jewish woman. Before, let's just make something clear. These awful and awesome punishments do not apply to people who don't know these things. Okay, but now you know about it. You're protected up to now, okay? A dispensation is made for people in our generation who can't understand these things, but if you understand it. And again, we're not talking here any discredit or anything negative about a non-Jewish woman. There's nothing wrong with a non-Jewish woman. You should hear the awesome punishments that are described for a man who has an intimate relationship with another man. Nothing wrong with this man or with that man. But the punishment for engaging in something where there cannot be a spiritual connection, that's what it is. Not because of any discredit to either. Why these two areas? Because a Jew who has an intimate relationship with a non-Jew can't be recognized anymore as Jewish. The most intense bond, the bond that is so intense that my life flows into that bond, so strongly that a new life comes out of that, somebody who puts himself into that with a non-Jew, so his life goes into that, and what comes out of it is not Jewish. So he can't any longer be recognized as a Jew. He's broken the covenant in either way, whichever way he breaks the bris. He's broken the covenant that bonds him in, a life and death covenant, and he's gone into a place where he makes a new covenant with that which one cannot bond with. This is not a vindictive thing, it's just a natural consequence. So what we're talking about is the fact that life depends. Life depends on somehow generating the consciousness of what it means to be Jewish, and it's an awesome work for us in this generation who don't have it. There are some people in this generation who still have it. There are some youth of this generation who somehow have it. Very often you'll see it wasn't in homes where it was given intensity. Sometimes it is, sometimes, but not necessarily. I would venture to say that it doesn't go in proportion. You find many homes where plenty of Jewish education was given, plenty of schooling in Jewish education was given, and the child has got no concept at all of the innate difference between Jew and non-Jew. And there are many homes where there wasn't much Jewish content given. And the Jew has a tremendous sense of strength, the child, of what it means to be Jewish, and he feels he could never bond with a non-Jew. Even he doesn't feel negative about non-Jews at all, but he feels he couldn't make a bond. If you have it, you are enormously lucky. If you have the faintest hint of an emotion in you that is something different about you than a non-Jew, you're enormously... If you don't have it, you have to gain it by an awesome work. You cannot open something You can open spiritual avenues in your neshama by doing certain Jewish things, because that spark is waiting to be ignited. But in this generation where that's been denied us, you cannot sit down with a non-Jewish, with a Jewish child, and start explaining there are no mystical, magical things you can do that suddenly will give it to them. It's a work of enormous difficulty. We try, and of course the spark does awaken. The spark does awaken. With a sincere effort and exposure to the right things, it does awaken, but it's miraculous. Let's try and explore briefly together for the next few minutes some of the root idea of what it means to be different, a Jew than a non-Jew, without getting into anybody being better than anybody else. That's not the point yet. There's no need even to get into that. If a non-Jew thinks that this is bigoted, he can become Jewish. If a non-Jew thinks that we have a superior attitude, that we actually are the ones who have a certain job in the world to do that nobody else can do, that we are superior, he really feels bad about it. What happens when he really feels bad about it, starts torturing Jews. That's the historical pattern. If he really feels bad about it and he really resents it, then become Jewish. No one's prohibited. Not close to anybody. If he really wants this load that we have to bear, if he really so admires, you follow? If he really so admires this load that it is that we have to bear, of what it means to be Jewish, for which we've died and been tortured, millions of us for centuries, right? For this, in his eyes, dubious privilege. Right? If he really wants it, he can have it. But obviously that's not the sincere motivation usually in history. If he really wanted it, he would have it. He doesn't want it, he just resents your having it. Let's try and understand a little bit about this idea. The Chumash says that when Yaakov met Esav, when the two of them met, Jacob and Esau, the twins born from the same mother at the same time, when the two of them met, a cosmic battle was pending. I mean, Yaakov felt that one of the two would survive. He felt that if things didn't go well, that he may not survive. He was very afraid. The thing to understand is that according to our mystical tradition, Esav, was the man who founded the non-Jewish religion, certainly the Western Bloc. Okay, But Yaakov was the man who was the father of the Jewish people. And we have a spark and a speck of his flame in each of us. Esau, was the man who fathered certainly the Western Bloc of nations. The Western culture, Western ideology, Western Bloc of nations. The Eastern nations we won't talk about at this point, and the Arabs, as you know, were fathered by a man called Ishmael. A different issue entirely. The Ramban says in the end the two will unite against us. The Esav Bloc and the Ishmael Bloc, the Arabs and the West, will all unite against us. Unfortunately, that may be the case unless we come right. But that could be. But that's another story. Ishmael was a different kind of a person. Ishmael did tshuva in the end, it says. In the end, he repented. He corrected his ways, it says. It says that he gave honor to his brother, Yitzchak. They let him go first when it came to burying their father. He did tshuva in the end. Let's not talk about that now. But the Western bloc, Western culture, which is what we've grown up on the knees of this Western, of this Esau ideology, this Esav culture, that needs some understanding. What one has to understand here, let's try and just pick out one idea, just one dimension of the many themes that run through their relationship, and try and make it clear, and then we'll try and look, maybe if we have time, to one or two practical applications. What exactly was the difference between them? What exactly was the difference, and what was it designed to do in the spiritual world? Let's try and understand, what is a non-Jew supposed to be doing in the world? What's he supposed to be doing? What's his job or her job in the world, as opposed to what my job is? If a man has a different job in the world, generally, than a woman, each one must learn to do what his job is, so that he can make a harmony, and as the two can make a harmony together. That's the concept, that Jew and non-Jew have got each a specific area to fulfill in life, and that the two of us can get married. That means that the future of the world can hinge on our cooperation, each one doing what he's supposed to be doing to achieve perfect harmony. That's what the mystics say, the meaning of twins. The meaning of twins is that the two of them, Moshe and Aaron, were brothers. Brothers, or twins especially, mean that there's a job that has to be done by the two of them together. So it pays to know what's your job and what's his job. There's nothing more suicidal than trying to do his job. Literally suicidal. Because it says that if you try and do his job, he's going to beat you back. It says clearly that the non-Jews, one of their prime functions is to teach you what it means to be Jewish. That's the root of anti-Semitism. That's the idea of what it means to be a non-Jew. And one of the themes that have been built into his personality is to make sure you remain Jewish. That's why there's a mystical principle that if Jews are very Jewish, the non-Jews will love us for it. And if Jews are not very Jewish, then the non-Jews, if we try and be like them, they'll hate us for it and make us be Jewish. The Gaon of Vilna is reputed to have said that if the Jew doesn't make Kiddush, the Goy makes Havdalah. You hear that? If the Jew doesn't make Kiddush, if you don't sanctify yourself with Kiddush, he'll make the distinction. He'll make, if you don't bring in Shabbos, he'll see the Shabbos goes out. That's what he's designed to do. That's what he's been put in the world to do, to help you in that way. What is the difference between these two twins? And let's just pick out the one theme that explains not just the differences, but what are the differences that are relevant to what they're supposed to be doing in the world, what we're supposed to be doing. We won't have time for the whole discussion. It's a fantastic and wide-ranging discussion that runs through Western history. But let's just try and pick out one or two elements. The word Esav means, the root of the word is Asui. Asui means fully made, fully formed. Fully formed. Fully expressed, fully formed. Yaakov doesn't mean made or formed at all. The word Yaakov means something that will be in the future, but it's not now. Yaakov means he will, and Akev means the heel. He will follow. He will follow on the heels of. In other words, he will come at the heels of everything else. In other words, he will be the last one to be manifest, but not now. Now is the one who has to be manifest now, the one who is ready and made for it. Yaakov will be. By the way, Jews are always called that way. Yitzchak, the father of the Jewish people, really, the one, the first child to be born to somebody who had the Torah ideology in the world. Yitzchak. His name means he will love. Yitzchak. He will love, not now. In the end, he will love. When the final reality is revealed, then those, that people, but we won't be laughing now, we'll be crying through most of history. That's the Jewish destiny. But in the end, we will love. And Yaakov means he will follow on the heels of Esav. In fact, he was born holding onto his heel. What could be more significant than that? He was born holding onto the heel of Esav. Esav came out first, fully formed and ready. Always there at the beginning, complete, he was hairy. Hair mystically means the ability to act and do in the world. I'm not going to go into why that is, but if you think about it, we've discussed enough mystical concepts here for, I'm sure, most of you to be already familiar with enough to realize that the body has hair in proportion to its ability to act. Is that right? In proportion to your ability to give out into the world, as opposed to take in or receive, that is where hair, the mystics say that's why men have got more hair than women, because the man is the one who acts out in the world, the woman takes in and receives. Hard to go into detail. And that's why the parts of the body, that are, the mystics say that at the root of organs of Ashpoah, that means parts of the body that act in the world, that produce in the world, always you find it. Why is that? Well, as we said before, if you think that it happened by a few million years of gorillas bumping into each other by accident, of course you won't achieve any understanding. You have to understand it mystically, in depth, in essence, and it means that, like the mystics say, that the arm, the root of the arm, under the arms there's hair. Because the arm is the organ of Ashpoah. The head, which is where all Ashpoah, all act, ability to manifest flows out. There's a deep idea we can't go into now. He was hairy. He was covered in hair. He was made Asui. Asui means he was fully made. In fact, his power was in his hands. The ability to do. When they came in front of their father, who could perceive their essence, so Yitzchak said, Akoil, Koil, Yaakov. The voice is the voice of Jacob, of Yaakov. By Yedayim, Yedayim, Esav. But the hands are the hands of Esav. Amazing revelation into their personality. The voice is what characterizes the Jewish people. Voice always being the connection between the spiritual and the physical worlds. The voice always being that which is the tool which enables you to take what's in the hidden world of your mind and put it into the world. The connection between the two. And the hands are the organs that actually achieve and do and manipulate the physical world. Esav was created to be a person, right? To manipulate the physical world. He was put in with the abilities, the tools and the abilities to perfect the physical world. Yaakov was the one who was put in not to perfect the physical world, to sit out of the physical world and make the connection between the perfected physical world and the spiritual world. It says that Esav was a man of the field, he was out in the world doing, and Yaakov was a man who sat in tents. Yoshev Oholim, sat in tents. Sat in tents learning Torah. He sat inside in the hidden inner dimension, learning the spiritual wisdom, absorbing and becoming part of the spiritual wisdom, and connecting himself to the spiritual world. What was the idea? The idea was that Esau was supposed to perfect the physical world. He was a man of tremendous power. He was supposed to perfect the physical world, bring it to its incredible epitome of beauty, and Yaakov was supposed to take that perfected physical world and connect it to the root. Of course, one without the other would be a failure. To have nobody to build the physical world, there'd be nothing to connect. And if there's a beautiful physical world and no one connects it to the source, disconnected from the source of existence, what's it worth? So they were designed to be the perfect twins, ultimate twins. They were designed to be a harmony in which they, the non-Jews, were given the job of perfecting the physical world in aesthetics, in practical reality, and we were given the job of totally staying away from the physical world and have nothing to do with it, leaving that to them, and studying the spiritual wisdom, getting involved in Torah, to the point that we would bring down the electricity from the spiritual world that could then connect with the physical world that they had built. That's the idea. If you want to know what a non-Jew is supposed to be doing, whom I respect very much, very bright man, with, unfortunately without a Torah background, he once said to me, why do you spend your time in yeshiva? Why aren't you out in the world doing something useful? Why aren't you out there building the world? So I said to him, for example, he said, go work in a power station. Because there you'll be turning the wheels that generate power, that flows out into the world. Just think what's done with the power. How many industries are run, and how many homes are lit and run by it, and how hospitals, just think what's done. You could have a share in that. I didn't have an answer. I didn't have an answer at the time. But the real answer is, he's quite right. Somebody has to be doing that. Somebody has to be turning the wheels and making things run. But if it doesn't end at a point where it means something, then what's the point of it? Imagine you work in a power station, and you send out kilowatts of energy through a lifetime, and houses are lit, and engineering, industrial things are run, and what for? What exactly for? For the people who live in those houses to die, so that somebody else can live in that house. So that his house can be lit and warmed, so that he can die and somebody else. So, in the end, what's it for? Now, nobody builds a system unless it does something in the end. And to keep the wheels of a machine running and turning, so that the machine keeps turning, and no one yet took out a patent for a machine. Imagine a man comes to the patent office with a machine. What does your machine do? Well, when you switch it on, it keeps itself oiled. You follow? It pours fuel into its fuel tank, and it keeps itself oiled. A very clever machine that keeps itself fueled and oiled. That's very nice. What does it actually do? No, that's what it does. It oils itself, and it keeps itself running. And it's got a very clever section that if it breaks down, it fixes itself again. So you say to him, yes, but what does it actually do? He says, no, that's what... In other words, you follow. Nobody yet built a machine like that. It would be very clever, but it would be the stupidest thing in the world. If your machine at the end of the day, imagine a machine that keeps itself running, that oils itself and fixes it. At the end of the day, it makes you a pizza. That's a clever machine. That you take out a patent on. That's not bad. But if the machine doesn't... So the secular world, the concept of existence in the secular world is maintenance for the sake of maintenance. Well, 99.9% of the people out there, out in this world culture, what exactly are they doing? What exactly are they busy with? They go to work each day and work hard, what for? So that they can have enough money to buy the food to do what? To go to work the next day. So that they can do what? So they can go to work. Isn't that pathetic? For what? For 3 weeks at the end of the year where they pass out unconscious on a beach. Or for the few hours on a weekend where they can regain their strength enough and get enough of a recharge to go back to spending the majority of their lives, generating enough income to keep generating income. Isn't that a pathetic embarrassment? Unfortunately, of course, most Jews on earth are involved in that also. Isn't that a pathetic embarrassment? Even if you have a sense of idealism and ideology, are you happy to spend the majority of your life in maintenance? Isn't that pathetic? That most people, Nebuch Jews especially, are spending the majority of their lives in maintenance for the odd occasion, the odd glimpse of a moment where there's something that gives you a feeling of elevation. Is that what you're here for? To spend so many years wasting most of it in just keeping going so you can keep wasting it? But it's a manifest tragedy. The truth is that that's needed, but you have to make the connection. At the end of the production line, there has to be production. So if you have two teams on earth, a team that keeps the wheels turning, that makes the whole thing function, but that's fantastic, that keeps everything going. But then you need a team at the end that connects the wires so that the machine does what it's supposed to do at the end. They don't have to be responsible for keeping the machine going and building the machine and making it beautiful. They have to direct it, they have to steer it towards where it's going. Now, there's a wonderful... Let me try and show you two examples, two illustrations of this. You know, there is a fantastic illustration of this. There's a very unusual thing, a very unusual aspect of Torah, which is this. Do you know that a non-Jew, if he wishes, may keep the whole Torah? I don't know if you're aware of that. If a non-Jew wishes to keep mitzvahs that he's not obliged to do, he may keep them. Similarly, a woman. If a woman wants to do mitzvahs that a man normally does, she's not obliged to do, she's allowed to. Or a Jew wants to do a mitzvah that he's not obliged to do, he's allowed to do that mitzvah and you get reward for it. Not the same as reward given to the person who's obliged to do it, but nevertheless you get reward. There were great women who put on talis and tefillin. Okay? Rashi's granddaughters, Michal Bat Shaul, it says. I'm not recommending it. Okay? We don't wish to see ladies here tomorrow morning at the Minyan with the talis and tefillin. But the point is that there are mitzvahs. If you want to do a mitzvah that you're not obligated in, you get reward for that mitzvah. And therefore it says that a non-Jew is allowed to keep all the mitzvahs of the Jews that he wants to. It says that Avraham Avinu kept the Torah of non-Jews. Of course, Torah hadn't been given yet. He had the din of a Gentile, of a non-Jew, and he kept the Torah voluntarily. But there are two exceptions. There are two exceptions. If this isn't a remarkable proof of what we said, I don't know what is. There are two mitzvahs that a non-Jew may not do on pain of death. What is that? Keep Shabbos and learn Torah. You hear that? A non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. Huh? Even a convert to Judaism. Even a person who's converting to Judaism has to break Shabbos somehow at least once, even while they're practicing, so that they can convert, so that they know everything. They have to do one thing wrong at least every Shabbos. They're not allowed to keep it. And they're not allowed to learn Torah for its own sake. Of course, they're allowed to learn all the... A convert, of course, has to learn Torah, because that's a person on their way to becoming Jew, so they have to absorb everything they need to know. But a non-Jew is not heading towards Torah, is only allowed to learn the Torah of those things that he's obligated in, his own mitzvahs. Non-Jews have certain mitzvahs, as it happens, seven. We have 613, they have seven. By the way, it makes up the mystical 620, which is what's called the 620 columns of light. Another subject. But they have only seven. Of course, you're aware of the fact that they have only seven, but theirs are more exacting than ours. You probably know that. A Jew has 613 mitzvahs, he has certain tolerances and leniencies built in. A non-Jew has seven, but he has no tolerance at all. He only has seven, he has to do them much more exactingly. It's a completely different pathway. Completely different reality, completely different pathway. Why is it that a non-Jew is not allowed to learn Torah or keep Shabbos? Why those two? And why does he forfeit his life if he does? Why so serious? He wants to learn Torah. He wants to know what's in Hashem's Torah. He should forfeit his life. He wants to rest on Shabbos. What's wrong with that? You're not harming anybody. A non-Jew wants to rest on Shabbos. What's the problem? He should forfeit his life for that? The answer is as follows. The most incredible thing to understand. The world is made up of two dimensions. Movement towards Tachlis. That means development and growth and movement towards the ultimate purpose and ultimate purpose. Like we explained before, you need both things. You need somebody who builds the reality, maintains it, builds the structure, builds the machine, and then you need someone who's going to direct the machine to get it to do what it's supposed to do. All the world that's manifest, in all the world you can only see maintenance. You look at the world, every mitzvah that you can see that a Jew does builds something real in the world. Every mitzvah works on you to make you kindly, to make you sensitive, or to teach you something, or to do something in the mystical world. Every mitzvah, everything does something in the world, that's a development. Everything in the world that you can ever find is something that is a development or builds something, moves towards an end result in the world. But there are only two things in the world that are an end result. The ultimate end result is Torah. That's why we learn Torah for no reason other than to learn it. A man doesn't sit down to learn Torah because he wants to know how to use it to earn a living or how to use it to do something else. The mitzvah of learning Torah is to sit down and learn Torah. Why? Because that is life. That is the end point. That is the end result. And Shabbos is the one occasion on earthly existence where you can actually feel Tachlis. And that's why the mitzvah of Shabbos is not to do anything. The mitzvah of Shabbos is not to build anything. Because you want to have a taste of what it means to have arrived. The rest of the week you have to build and build and build. But Shabbos is a time where you want to stop. Of course, it's got nothing to do with work. It's got to do with creative energy that you expend during the week to build yourself. On Shabbos, you want to stop building yourself and feel what it likes to be, what it feels like, feel what it feels like to have arrived, to enjoy who you are without going anyplace. So we stop ourselves going anyplace. In other words, there's one mitzvah where you can experience what the end point is. That's Shabbos. And the real end point is Torah. If a non-Jew does that, he doesn't deserve to live. Because his job is building. Our job is making the connection. You follow? His job is to keep building. He dare not stop. The beauty of a non-Jewish neshama, the beauty of what a non-Jew has to do in the world, is to build the beauty and the reality of the world. He should be busy all the time. He should be busy with maintenance and creativity and building. That's what he's supposed to be doing. If he takes a break, he forfeits his life. He's not doing anything now. You follow? His job is to be building once he's sitting down, taking a break. He takes Shabbos. What is Shabbos? To stop building. That's what it means. A non-Jew is allowed to have a rest. I'm not saying not allowed to have a rest. He must have a rest so he can keep building. We're not talking about resting. Shabbos is not resting. We're talking about the special mystical dimension of withholding your hand from spiritual creativity. A non-Jew's purpose in the world is creativity. He must build the world. If he takes a day where he stops building the world, he doesn't deserve to be here. That's all he's supposed to be doing. And a Jew? If a Jew gets involved in building the world, doesn't deserve to live. If a Jew gets involved in building the physical world, isn't that what he's here for? That's what the non-Jew is supposed to be doing. He's supposed to be building the world into a most beautiful, incredibly aesthetic place, and functional place, and just and moral and structured place. He's supposed to be doing. But the Jew is here to put the final, the production, what comes out of the machine at the end. That's our job. So you, instead of being here, getting the machine to do what it's supposed to be doing, you're over there doing the maintenance. You're trying to be the mechanic, keeping the machine going and making it look beautiful. But you just left your post over here, which is getting the machine to turn out what it's supposed to be turning out. The truth is, that's much more complicated than that. I'm not going to go into this in detail. The truth is that the non-Jews aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. The truth is that the Jewish pathway now in the world is to see to it that the physical world is maintained and built and that it comes to Estachlis. Because the non-Jews aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. Do you think they're putting the effort out there into building the world so that we can make this visual connection? They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Unfortunately, before you get this bigoted feeling, I can't say that Jews are out there doing what Jews are supposed to be doing. Before we start criticizing them for not doing the right thing. Before we do that, we have to work out whether are we here putting the final connection in? Can you say the majority of, are we really striving for that? If you feel that you can say that you as a Jew are really striving to put the spiritual content into the world, to make it connect with the Torah source, and to make Hashem's presence manifest, if you really dedicated your life to that, then maybe you can start looking at one or two of your non-Jewish friends and explain to them that they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. But I'm not sure any of us can really say that. There's one beautiful proof of this. There's a Gaon of Vilna that says the following thing. Very, very beautiful thing. There's a Gemara, I think it's in Avodah Zorah, the Gemara says this. The Gemara says that in the next world, Hashem will call everyone to task for not doing what he was supposed to be doing. Everybody will be judged. So it says the non-Jews will appear in front of Hashem, and Hashem will start, and the Gemara says exactly what will be said, how the conversation will go. The Gemara says this, Hashem will say to the non-Jews, why didn't you do what I put you on earth to do? We're talking about non-Jews now, okay, before we get carried away again. Unfortunately, there are discussions of what's going to be said to us, okay, before we get carried away with this feeling of superiority. We're just not discussing that right now. But Hashem says to the non-Jews, why didn't you do what I put you into the world to do? I put you in, so the non-Jews say, well, we did. Look what you did in the world. You built bridges. You built cities. You built roads. We did all that in the world. So Hashem said, yeah, but you didn't. Why did you do that? So the non-Jews say, so that Israel could learn Torah. We built the world so that Jews, why did we build roads? So that a Jew could travel on that road and get to Yeshiva and learn Torah. Why did we build bridges? For the same reason. Why cities? We built everything in the world. This is what they say to Hashem. Brazen-faced chutzpah. They say to Hashem, we built the world, and we kept it going, and we poured our taxes into it, and we poured our back-breaking labor into it, to keep the world a beautiful place so that the Jews could come and put Torah into it. So Hashem says to them, Rishon, you evil people, you didn't do it for that. You didn't do it for that. You did it, and the Gemara goes through the details. You built cities to house prostitutes. And you build roads for your own financial benefit. And the Gemara goes through exactly, unfortunately, what it's all for. I mean, you don't need this to be spelled out. I mean, go and look in the world out there. Are they? Yes, did you find a non-Jew yet? Did you find yet a non-Jew who's out there busy building roads so you can get to Yeshiva? I don't know if you found that yet. Unfortunately, not too many people using those roads to get to Yeshiva anyway, like I said. Let's keep this fair. But that's what it's supposed to be. Now, the Gaon of Vilna, and then Hashem, then there's a big argument. Then there's a big argument between them, and then the non-Jews eventually say, well, we didn't because you didn't give us mitzvahs, and Hashem gives them a mitzvah, he gives them a mitzvah of sukkah, and they go build a sukkah. That's what happens in the next world. They say it's unfair, you didn't give us a chance, you gave the Jews a chance, Hashem gives them a chance. A very interesting discussion, what happens. I'll tell you, ask me privately what happens some other time. But the point that we want is this. The Gaon of Vilna says the following thing. First of all, you have to understand, what are these brazen-faced liars? Hashem is saying to them that you didn't do your job, and they try to fool Hashem and say we did? Well, what are they thinking? That they're going to fool the master of the universe? Obviously, they feel they've got a leg to stand on. Obviously, they must have felt they were pretty close to it. So the Gaon says this. Beautiful thing. He says, you see from Hashem's criticism of the non-Jewish nations for not building bridges and for not building the world and for not doing all these things for the right. You follow? The criticism that he levels at them for not doing what they should have done, from that you see what they should have done. The Gemara is interested in showing you the criticism and how they'll try and get out of it and how they'll be caught in the end. But you see obliquely from this Gemara, You see clearly what it is that Hashem would never take them to task for not doing things they didn't want them to do. Obviously, this is what they were supposed to be doing. So what do you take out of this Gemara? Exactly what we've been saying. That the function of the non-Jewish nations is exactly to do... That means when you speak to non-Jewish idealists, and they believe that they're here for a positive function, they're here to build the world and make it a beautiful place. They always talk that way. To perfect the world, to bring a just, to bring... Yeah, to build the world in all its beauty and glory. And the Greek, the Roman, the Greeks, who were the fathers of the Roman ideology, which is the basis of the Aesop culture, of the Western culture there, revolves around aesthetics, to build the world into a beautiful place. They couldn't be closer to the truth. They couldn't be closer. They just left out one thing, which is the spiritual motivation. They just left out the reason that they should be doing it, unfortunately. And just like many of us have forgotten what it is and why it is that we're supposed to be doing what we're supposed to be doing. There's much more to say about the subject. We'll leave it at this point. What we've said this evening is this. There's many more practical things we have to get into. The practical, maybe next time, Mr. Shim, we have to talk about what is it in practice that we should be doing as Jews. What should we be avoiding because it takes us away from our tachlis? What is it that a non-Jew should be advised to be doing if he asks you for advice? What does the Torah say about what he should be doing? How do you conduct yourself in a society that's hostile to this idea? How should you conduct yourself? Should a Jew have a proud, high-profile image in the world, like in their terms or in our terms? Or should he have a low-profile image where he's not seen? How should he bring himself into this potential conflict? Now, this all learned from the meeting of Yaakov and Esau. But all we learned this evening was that there is unfortunately, a blurring of the distinction between Jew and non-Jew. That's the norm in this generation. It, by logical explanation, you know, half an hour's discussion with somebody, logical explanation, delving into Jewish history and the external trappings, external aspects of what Torah is, are not going to make any difference to anybody in this generation, not to the youth of this generation. You have to reawaken, we have to reawaken somehow the spark of what it means to understand intuitively and intimately what it means to be a Jew. That spark has to be reawakened. The best we can do, for those who don't have it, to reawaken that spark, is to get immersed in what it is that we're supposed to be doing. If a person immerses himself in the tachlis, a person understands Shabbos correctly, and he lives Shabbos as an experience, as a positive experience, not just not doing something. That's a non-Jew Shabbos. He has to live Shabbos as doing something spiritual, that's the real doing. And if a person lives Torah, which is the Jewish feeling, and a person immerses himself in Torah for its own sake, a person gets a conscious, intuitive feeling that is involved in what life is. And there's no place to go from here. That this is the place where I want to be. It has that incredible attraction, that incredible pull, that incredible feeling that oneness has been achieved. That's why the mystics say that learning Torah is a sublimation of a man's desire to be together with a woman. The feeling that a man has when he's with his wife, the unity of husband and wife, it's that amazing ability that a man puts into Torah. Because it's a completion, it's a reaching of oneness that there's no place to go from here. And of course that's what breeds real spiritual life in the world.